You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. Coming up on our summer music series set list, we'll hear from Minneapolis singer Caroline Smith. She'll tell us about her musical transition from folk to neo-soul music.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup.
A report released this week called into question a state tax credit program for manufacturing and agriculture.
Also this week, a ruling by the Supreme Court changed an abortion law here in Wisconsin, and Senator Ron Johnson is continuing his fight against the regulation of vaping.
Robert Mentzer joins us now for more on those stories. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's great to be back.
Let's start with that Wisconsin Budget Project report. It came out earlier this week looking at the state's manufacturing and agricultural tax credits. So what was said in this report?
Yeah, so it turns out that there's tax credit has been a giant boon to some very rich people. It is the credit was passed in the 2011 budget, and it has been phasing in over time since then, and next year it will be sort of fully phased in. It will allow people to claim 7.5% of their income from agricultural or a manufacturing company as a credit against their personal income tax. So what it'll do is it'll wipe out the state income tax for a huge number of people, including thousands of people who earn over $1 million a year, and there will be a tax cut of a total of $21.5 million all told will go to just 11 taxpayers in Wisconsin, all of whom make more than $35 million per year.
What was the original reasoning behind these tax credits focused on manufacturing and agricultural industries?
Well, so this was the Wisconsin is open for business era. Republicans had come into office and they wanted to do a lot of different things to try to spur the economy. And there was not, they weren't wrong. Like hiring wasn't good and the economy wasn't doing great at that time. So it's, the charitable reading is that this was part of a larger effort to spur hiring in the economy. It's just that I think that when you really get a look at just how regressive this particular tax credit is in the way that it's been, in practice, I think that's where a lot of the criticism comes in.
Is there any indication, at least from this report or from the response to it, that maybe some jobs are created? The people who saved this money then invested that money in these kind of businesses and created the kind of jobs the state was trying to create?
Sure, that's the argument, and the state's head of the Department of Revenue, Richard Chandler, noted that manufacturing job growth in recent years has surpassed the national average, and that is true. But it's very iffy, and I don't think the staunchest defender can claim that that there's some kind of direct correlation between this particular tax cut and that manufacturing job growth. I think that's a hard case to make.
And have Democrats been running with this issue?
Yeah, so, as you might imagine, it's right in their wheelhouse. This came about because Assembly Representative Gordon Hintz, who is a Democrat, requested that the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, the nonpartisan sort of number-crunching agency, break down the effect of this particular tax credit by income levels. That hadn't been done previously, so there would be like large round numbers on what the tax credit was costing the state, but not who specifically it was going to. So this is, absolutely. This is a sort of tailor-made for Democratic talking points.
In national news this week, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a Texas law that required abortion providers to, among other things, have admitting privileges at area hospitals. The next day, an appeal from Wisconsin and Mississippi was denied by the Supreme Court, kind of following on that ruling. How does this all affect us here in Wisconsin?
Right, so this is a landmark ruling for the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn those Texas laws. Texas, like a lot of states that are controlled by Republicans, had passed a bunch of regulations on abortion clinics, and one of those that had passed some similar regulations was Wisconsin. The stated goal of all of those laws, including admitting privileges, but also extending to a number of other types of regulations, was supposed to protect the health and safety of women who were receiving services at those clinics. But critics and now the majority of justices on the Supreme Court contended that the real purpose was basically to close abortion clinics or to limit access to abortion. So Wisconsin's law had already been struck down in a federal appeals court, but in a different federal appeals court, the Texas laws had been upheld. So it was sort of up to the Supreme Court to resolve that, and this week they resolved it, and that means that that Wisconsin's appeal of its of its ruling also was resolved the next day, and the laws are unconstitutional.
It's our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup with Rob Mentzer. Rob, response here in the state, first of all, from state officials who were defending this law.
Certainly there is a committed and passionate group of anti-abortion activists in Wisconsin, and they continue to that is an animating issue and an important issue to a lot of people. So I don't in no way are they sort of intending to throw in the towel. I think that we've seen in state budgets cuts to Planned Parenthood funding, and that's something that that Governor Walker specifically has favored. And I think that there's also the continuing kind of hearts and minds discussion around the abortion issue, because it is it's a charged issue, and it's one that that inspires really very passionate activism on both sides.
And then finally, Rob, this week we learned a Wisconsin senator, Senator Ron Johnson, has become a key player on the issue of government regulation of the vaping industry. This is reported in the Journal Sentinel earlier this week. Why is Senator Johnson a big part of this story?
Yeah, so Senator Johnson, this is a post by the Journal Sentinel's watchdog reporter Daniel Bice on his watchdog blog on the sort of personal interaction of Senator Johnson's close relationship, fondness, just sort of a professional affiliation with the right-wing talk show host, radio talk show host Vicky McKenna. Johnson said in a podcast that his campaign put out that that he loves Vicky McKenna and wants to help to fight for a cause that is dear to her, which is keeping the Food and Drug Administration away from e-cigarettes.
Right, and the idea being, she said that e-cigarettes helped her quit smoking, helping other people quit smoking. Some experts saying it doesn't seem to be that helpful compared to other quit smoking aids. It's a live issue, though, it sounds like, in Wisconsin and around the country.
For sure. People love it. I think a lot of people have an intuition that vaping, which is a practice of getting high on nicotine by breathing in sort of water vapor instead of smoking a cigarette, people intuit that must be less harmful because there isn't smoke and tar and stuff. But the truth is that there have not been any long-term scientific studies of health effects. And so, in general, public health types tend to argue that it needs to be regulated and, frankly, socially stigmatized a lot the same way that tobacco smoking is. But that, that is certainly it is government regulation, and that is government meddling. And so, from the conservative point of view, that is something to be fought against, and that's a cause that Senator Johnson has taken up.
One to watch. Rob, thanks a lot for joining us, as always.
All right, thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer with USA Today Network Wisconsin, helping us recap the biggest stories from around the state in our Wisconsin News Roundup.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, we talk to a transgender veteran and a transgender advocate about an end to a ban that stopped transgender Americans from serving in the U.S. military.
First, we continue our summer music series set list. We invited artists from all over the Midwest into the WPR studios for interviews and exclusive musical performances that air every Friday at this time until Labor Day weekend.
Today, we feature the Minneapolis singer Caroline Smith. She and her band recently stopped by the WPR studio to play songs from her new album and talk about the role feminism played in her musical transition from folk to neo-soul.
Thank you so much for coming into the studio to play today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it sounds like you grew up with music just all around you. What effect did your parents' music have on your decision to go on and become a musician?
Well, my dad taught me how to play guitar, the guitars would come out at every huge Irish party, and I just wanted to like be cool like my brother, which is why I learned how to play guitar. But my mom always put a huge emphasis on songwriting, and you know, we'd listen to Paul Simon and Carole King and Aretha Franklin, and she'd be like, "Do you hear that? Like, that's a real song. That's a solid song." And we would just talk about it, and it seeped in there.
Did you say Irish party?
Yeah.
Irish party. So you had Irish folk music going on in your house?
Yeah, for sure. Oh, my God. Yeah, my dad loved, like, the Chieftains. That was his band.
And you ended up starting your career anyways as an indie folk singer.
Yeah.
Did that folk sensibility come from your dad?
Yeah, I would say so. I think that mostly what happened, though, was I just started playing acoustic guitar, and I started writing songs on the acoustic guitar without really knowing what I was doing. But I think when you're writing really simple songs with really simple chords, what comes out is folk music. And I had no expectation that that was going to catch on, or people were going to want to hear me sing those every night, you know?
So would you have chosen that for yourself if that isn't what came out?
No, I mean, my favorite record of all time growing up, like my dad had to keep buying it for me over and over again, was TLC Crazy Sexy Cool. So like in my head, like I was writing like sassy songs about like boys in the lunch line. And then it kind of like narrowed down when I was in high school, and music that was really popular was like Iron and Wine and Joanna Newsom, and that really resonated with me, and it kind of like came together in this big, you know, amalgamation that is Caroline.
A small town in Minnesota called Detroit Lakes.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a particular kind of music there that influenced you that was popular with where you lived?
Yeah, I mean, I hate country music. I can't stand. I like classic, like Dolly Parton, but you know, that's like neo country is just like, oh, it's the worst. And everybody listens to that there. So it was either that or it was like what was on TRL. Also, I had this really awesome disco record that I loved with like It's Raining Men on it, and I Will Survive, and Bad Girls. I love that record.
Sounds like you kind of imprinted on that, even though you had this folk thing going on the side.
Yep.
Be all right now, just do it, do it, do it, do it, do it. Do it, do it, do it, do it, do it.
Okay, babe, come on.
Do it, do it, do it, do it, do it, do it.
Hey!
All that I know is,
all that I know is,
baby,
ooh, baby, I'm yours, I'm your girl.
And did I read that your mom got you some of your first gigs?
Yeah, my mom was like my stand-in manager, and she still likes to think that she is my mom. I got it, I'm 27. But yeah, my mom heard me playing guitar down in my bedroom and was like, first of all, you have a guitar. Second of all, you can play it. And she's like, you're really good. Like, we should book some shows. And I was like, okay. And then that was how it all snowballed.
A little bit about how you got to where you are today, because we started by talking about how you had these folk root traditions and you followed that, but then it sounds like your band hit sort of this crisis where you weren't sure what was coming next and you realized what you really wanted to do, and that was not really folk per se, but it was more this neo-soul sound.
Right.
So how did that happen?
What happened was I started making music when I was younger, when I was like 16, 17, 18, with no idea that that was going to latch on. And who I was then is very different than who I am now. And it's like basically like having a journal that everybody then bought copies of the journal and they want you to read out of your journal every time you're in their city. And I was just growing past that, and I wanted to start playing the music that I grew up listening to. You know, I was playing music that I liked in high school, but that wasn't what was deep in my soul. And so I felt really conflicted when it was time to write the next record, because I wanted my fans to be happy. It blows my mind that I have fans every single day, and they're so important to me. But the songs that were coming out were just not spirited. They just weren't, I wasn't excited about them. It wasn't the music I wanted to be making anymore. And I started writing these like pop songs with a friend of mine, and I was like, oh, this will be for another project. And I just started writing more of these like songs that reminded me of people that I grew up listening to, like, you know, Beyonce and Justin Timberlake and Carole King, you know, like people that I wanted to like dance and sing to. And then it just kind of, I showed my band and they were like, these are great. These sound like you. This is you. This is more you than the other stuff. And it just kind of stuck. And I was like, all right, let's do this. And thank God my fans liked it. This is so different.
Right, because that could have been a hard moment with your band, too. I was thinking that you could come with this new stuff. And they go, right. What is this? We didn't sign up for this.
Yeah. The fabric of our friendship is all built on, you know, our interests are so similar. So, you know, in the van, we listen to a ton of D'Angelo, listen to a ton of Bilal, listen to a lot of like neo soul artists, and we would get out of the van and we would go play folk music. And I think all of us were getting a little like, well, this is not who we are anymore, you know?
Yeah, and the other thing I read was that during this period, you also emerged as a feminist.
Yeah.
Does that show up in your music?
I grew up with a single mother who worked a lot, and she was just a vehement feminist. And I grew up with that mindset. And then when I started, you know, getting the confidence to say what I wanted to say and make the music that I wanted to make, all of that stuff just bubbled up inside of me, like the Caroline, the real Caroline that, you know, that was deep down. And that is a huge part of who I am with my girlfriends. It's a huge part of who I am as a woman in the music industry. And it all just came out really naturally.
A lot of the younger generation, I would say a lot, but there is a strand of in the group of younger women who don't want to identify as feminist anymore.
Right.
Why do you think it's important for you to just say it?
I think it's important because for a long time, the word feminist had a really negative connotation. You know, we're burning our bras and we hate men. But that's not true. Literally, feminist just means you believe in the equality of the sexes. And I think a lot of people are feminists. They just don't know it, you know? They're like, well, that word is so scary. But it's really not. And if you believe that women should be paid not 77 cents to the man's dollar, which I'm pretty sure all the guys back there in the sound booth believe, then you're a feminist. It's really that simple. And feminists, they can be a stay-at-home mom. They could be a plumber. They can be standing on stage every night on tour. We can shave our legs and wear makeup and still believe that we should be paid just as much as a man. Oh, baby, take this. Damn it, put something on. And clean up yourself now. It got her to take you home. Yeah, I know you were lonely. You needed to feel like that dude.
Well, let's talk about your latest album. It's called Half About Being a Woman. How would you describe it?
I would say it's the most honest music I've ever made. And there are a couple moments where I really explore some realer parts of who I am. And they're not always pretty. They're not always attractive. So I would say it's like a feel-good record that has really honest and sparing moments in it.
And the title, Half About Being a Woman. Mm-hmm. So is that a reflection on you kind of growing up through music?
Yeah, I think that it was a kind of like a nod to the duality that lives in all women, you know, this confidence that's paired with a struggle for self-esteem, you know. And I think a lot of women have to fake it till they make it. They're like, you pretend like you're Beyonce, like you have that confidence, so you can just have an ounce of that and you don't have to be beat down by, you know, advertising and get better skin and a thinner waist, you know. You just have to really protect yourself.
So do you think about, just based on the messages you're saying, do you think about how your songs might play to a 12-year-old who's listening, a 13-year-old girl?
Yeah, I guess I don't think about it when I'm writing it. I just try to be honest and sing what's in my heart. But there was a woman that came to my show, and she couldn't bring her daughter, but she was like, I just want you to know, like, what you do for my daughter is, it's, I really appreciate it. You're a role model for her. And that just like hit me super hard in my heart, because I never pictured myself as a role model, and I just really appreciated it. And then I like combed through all my songs in my head about like all the like the swear words and stuff like that. I'm like, oh well, okay.
You started performing so young and recording so young, and now, I mean, you're still young. It's not to say, hey, here you are in middle age, but you can sort of trace this line. What do you think listening back is like for you now?
It used to be hard to listen to because it was embarrassing. I'd be like, oh God, I can't believe I wrote a song about my dog and then released it into the world. But now I think it's just cute. You know, you like read back to old journals and you're like, oh, you were just so green. You were so fresh. You didn't know anything about the world.
Any goals about where you want to go next?
I have one goal in my mind that I'm just like focusing on. I will play SNL. That is my goal. Like, I'm coming for you, Saturday Night Live. I'm coming for you.
Caroline, thank you so much for coming to the studio today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was Minneapolis singer Caroline Smith. You can catch her live on September 5th at the Red Herring Lounge in Duluth.
The Setlist Summer Music Series airs every Friday at this time through Labor Day weekend. Support for Setlist comes from Hyde Music. For more about the artists featured on Setlist, including songs and videos of their exclusive performances at our WPR studio, head over to WPR.org/setlist.
Coming up, the Pentagon is lifting the ban on transgender Americans serving in the military. We'll talk to a transgender veteran and policy expert to learn more. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight at 7, it's Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. Tonight, the 8-member Supreme Court released key decisions in the past week, with special attention focused on the issues of abortion rights and immigration. Robert Barnes of The Washington Post lays out the cases and explores how they could play out politically. That's tonight at 7 on Ken Rudin's Political Junkie.
First, one of the last barriers to serving in the military was lifted yesterday. The Pentagon announced the end of the ban that barred transgender Americans from serving in the U.S. military.
Here's Defense Secretary Ash Carter announcing the end of the ban after studying the possible integration of transgender Americans into the military.
Now, as a result of this year-long study, I'm announcing today that we're ending the ban on transgender Americans in the United States military. Effective immediately, transgender Americans may serve openly, and they can no longer be discharged or otherwise separated from the military just for being transgender. Additionally, I have directed that the gender identity of an otherwise qualified individual will not bar them from military service or from any accession program.
The new rule was considered a big win for advocates who have called for greater inclusion in the military, but the decision hasn't been without opposition. Republican chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Mac Thornberry, said that the move was prioritizing politics over policy.
Colonel Sherry Swakowski of Wisconsin joins us now in the studio. She's a retired U.S. Army colonel and highest-ranking transgender veteran in the country. Sherry, thanks for joining us today.
It's good to be with you.
And with us on the phone is Aaron Belkin. He's the founding director of the Palm Center, a research institute that focuses on gender, sexuality, and the military. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
It's an honor.
Well, Sherry, let's start with you. And as someone who had served in the military under the regime that just ended now, what was your reaction to this news?
Oh, I was elated, and that's putting it mildly. This is just going to be such a wonderful thing for the 14,000 plus service members, transgender service members that are serving, that can now serve openly.
you were a person who couldn't serve openly. You've told your story elsewhere, but can you share some of what that experience was like for you in the military?
It was very difficult. I was a career infantry officer, and being in the infantry is difficult enough. But not being able to be authentic, I was forced to suppress this deeply for decades just in order to be the best leader I could be.
Aaron, this policy has been in the works for some time now after some research and study went into it. Can you spell out how this works, what changes under this new announcement, and what's the timeline?
Well, what Secretary Carter said yesterday is that the ban is now lifted and we have open service, and that's a historic change that strengthens the military. There will be a phased-in implementation. So as of yesterday, transgender people can serve openly in the military. They don't have to lie about who they are. The services are allowed to start providing medically necessary care, and in 90 days, the services will be required to provide medically necessary care. And then in a year, the enlistment regulation will be changed so that transgender identity is no longer a bar to service. But what's most critical is that this strengthens the military by allowing people to serve authentically.
How many people are we talking about who have been serving in the military, who are currently serving, and who might serve in the future?
There are different estimates, which is very common for social science. You know, you administer 5 presidential polls in one day, and you get slightly different numbers. But the range is between 2 and 15,500. So somewhere, you know, and you can take an estimate in the middle if you like. But so the number I use from the New England Journal of Medicine is 14,800, and there are approximately 134,000 transgender veterans.
And Aaron, part of the rule here is that transgender Americans would have to show that they've been, quote, stable, unquote, in their preferred gender for at least 18 months and show their transition is complete. That's as they're coming in. Can you explain that, of what exactly that means?
Yeah, that's actually not quite right. But I would like to say first that, you know, there are implementation details and there are footnotes and policy nuances to talk about, and I'll answer your question in a second. But what's most important about yesterday is that the ban is lifted and that open service is the new reality. And I think that's really important for people to remember. But in terms of how the policy works, it's not quite right that people are going to have to show medical stability for 18 months before getting into the military, because many transgender people do not need to transition and are already stable and fully fit for duty, and they will be welcomed into the military. It's only that if someone has started treatment for gender dysphoria, then there needs to be 18 months of medical stability. But just to contextualize that, the military attaches delays to all kinds of medical conditions because they want to make sure that people coming into the military are healthy. So if you have depression, you have to show that you're stable for several years before the military will let you in. And so the 18 months is very consistent with other military regulations.
We're talking about this announcement of the end of the transgender ban in the U.S. military that came out yesterday. Aaron Belkin with us from the Palm Center. Colonel Sherry Swakowski of Wisconsin, a U.S. Army retired with us. Sherry, let's bring you back in on this now. A criticism when a change like this is made, whether we're talking about the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, allowing women into combat roles, the end of this transgender ban now, is unit cohesion. There's a worry that this group, a new group or not newly openly serving group, could create some sort of conflict or tension in a military unit. How do you address a concern like that?
Well, I think the military actually teaches us to anticipate change, to accept it, to commit to it, and then go on and continue performing the mission. And I fully expect this to happen the same way. I don't really think it's going to be a big thing. When Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed, we didn't really see but a blip on the radar screen after that, and I think this will all occur the same way.
If you were still on active duty now, how would this, as you see it, as you look back, have improved your experience, maybe even your performance as an officer?
Exactly. I often think back and wonder, had I been allowed to transition, be authentic, be myself while serving the federal government and the Army, how much better of a, not only an NCO and officer, but how much better of a human being I would have been.
Aaron, can you talk a little bit about the road to yesterday's announcement? How long was this in the works? How many people like Sherry were working on this issue?
Well, service members started to challenge the constitutionality of the ban in court many decades ago, more than 30 years ago. But that having been said, the issue really wasn't part of the national policy conversation during the Don't Ask, Don't Tell years, and there were reasons for that I can I'm glad to discuss. But it was only about 3 years ago when Kristen Beck first told her story to the country that the conversation was amplified up to the national level, and you started to see an organized campaign to change the policy. So given the many decades it took to achieve equality for other groups, this was a very fast campaign.
Aaron, as we mentioned, Mac Thornberry, Republican chair of the House Armed Services Committee, said this is putting politics over policy. This is a symbolic political feel-good from the Democratic side, not really considering the effects on the military. On the Senate side of things, Senator John McCain, not so critical, but he says he wants to hold hearings, wants to talk to the leaders of the armed forces. Do you think there's going to be political backlash? Do you think there's going to be enough that this policy announced yesterday may not be the end of the story?
No. Secretary Carter announced very clearly that he consulted with and got buy-in from the top leaders of the services. And I think that they understand quite well. In fact, General Milley said a few weeks ago at the confirmation hearing for Army Secretary Fanning that anyone who's qualified to do the job should be allowed to serve in the military. And I think people understand quite well that what undermines military readiness is when people have to live a lie. And what undermines unit cohesion and military readiness is when the troops don't get medically necessary care. So it's really the ban that was undermining military readiness, and that's what the research shows. That's what we learned under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That's what foreign militaries learned. So anyone who's concerned about military readiness, as the chiefs are, understand that yesterday's move is a move in the direction to promote readiness.
And Sherry?
Yes, and Aaron is exactly right. You know, we already know that transgender service members are some of the top rated in their units at their job. So when you take that and you allow them to be authentic and to serve as themselves and obtain the medically necessary care, their job performance is going to improve. And that can only help increase individual and subsequently unit readiness.
We're talking about the Pentagon's recent announcement of an end to the ban that barred transgender Americans from serving in the military. We're talking with Colonel Sherry Swakowsky of Wisconsin, retired Army colonel and highest-ranking transgender veteran in the country. Also with us, Aaron Belkin, founding director of the Palm Center, a research institute that focuses on gender, sexuality, and the military.
And we want to hear from you. Are you someone who's been excluded or had difficulty entering the military because of your gender or your sexual orientation? You can call us now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. If you're a current or former member of the military, tell us how inclusive you had your experience was. And what do you think of the military's decisions over the past few years lifting the don't ask, don't tell policy or more openness to women in combat roles? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
More coming up in just a few moments here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation now with Aaron Belkin, founding director of the Palm Center, a research institute that focuses on gender, sexuality, and the military, and Sherry Swakowsky, retired Army colonel and highest-ranking transgender veteran in the country. We're looking at the Pentagon's announcement that it would lift the ban on transgender Americans serving in the military. That came out yesterday.
And we want to hear from you on this. Are you a veteran or a current member of the armed services? What did you think of the announcement from Secretary Carter lifting the ban? Do you think the military is becoming more open and inclusive to the LGBT community and to women? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of some of the specific stipulations in the new rules, like having a stable gender identity or 18 months before enlisting? You can call us at 800-642-1234.
And Aaron, I wanted to ask, you mentioned at one point other militaries, foreign militaries, who have maybe been through this already. Can you talk about what this process has looked like elsewhere in the world?
Sure, and that was one of the critical elements, I think, in helping military leaders and Washington leaders understand that inclusive policy promotes readiness was to look at the 18 foreign militaries that have allowed transgender personnel to serve openly, and those include militaries that we respect very much and work with closely, Britain, Israel, Canada, Australia, so 18 foreign militaries, and those militaries have not reported problems. There's been no compromise to unit cohesion or morale or readiness or anything like that, which, by the way, also mirrors the experiences of federal agencies such as the CIA and the FBI, all of which allow transgender personnel to serve. So the military was really behind the times here and was the only remaining entity in the entire government that still required discrimination until yesterday.
And Sherry, we've talked about your own experience in the military some. Is this something you've heard from people, the ban that just ended yesterday, that kept people from going in the military, people who might otherwise have been well qualified for it?
I don't know personally anybody who has not been able to serve. I do know personally some highly trained and very intelligent individuals that were discharged because of being transgender and just in the past 3 or 4 years.
Do you think that that led to a lot of fear among people who couldn't openly serve under their gender identity, that it would be discovered somehow they might be ousted from the military?
Well, exactly. What's happened, this has been a very collaborative effort between DOD and the medical experts and advocacy groups like the Palm Center and SPARTA. But the real heroes of this are the brave transgender men and women who are serving on active duty and in the reserve components currently, who have pushed the issue by coming out to their commands over the last 2 years. They're the real heroes here.
Aaron, I want to talk a little more about the study process that Sherry was just talking about. This was first announced in the neighborhood of a year ago that this process was starting. Can you talk a little more about what went into that that led to yesterday's decision?
Well, the Pentagon did a very careful analysis, and they also commissioned the RAND Corporation, which is a highly respected military think tank that was created by the Air Force a generation ago. They asked the RAND Corporation to do a separate study. So there were two comprehensive study processes going on in the military and then in the RAND Corporation. And RAND generated its report, and they found that repeal of the ban would not compromise readiness and would be uncomplicated to implement and would have no implications for cost. RAND didn't find any disadvantages, and I think that research, which also followed the other research that had already been done by, for example, retired generals and admirals and former U.S. Surgeons General and other scholars and leading experts, there was a mountain of evidence all confirming the same point, which is that inclusive policy promotes readiness. And I think that it was just so impressive to see the Pentagon make policy on the basis of data and reason and evidence instead of the old model under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, when policy was driven by fear and emotion rather than evidence.
Sherry, do you have a message maybe for people out there listening, might be a transgender themselves in the military, thinking of going into the military? What would you say to them on the day after this announcement?
I would say that the military is a wonderful organization to belong to, and the fact that you are transgender can no longer hold you back from entry and serving authentically.
And what does this mean to you this week? This is something you've been looking for a long time as a veteran, as somebody who lived, served in the military under the old regime. Talk about just, I guess, the emotional impact that you feel about this.
It's been very emotional. And as you said, we've been working on this for several years. And the winners in this, of course, are the people that are serving on active duty now and the people that are going to serve on active duty in the future.
We'll leave it there for now. Sherry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Aaron, thanks for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to Colonel Sherry Swakowski. She's a retired U.S. Army colonel, the highest-ranking transgender veteran in the country. Also with us by phone was Aaron Belkin, founding director of the PALM Center. That's a research institute that focuses on gender, sexuality, and the military. They talked to us about this announcement yesterday from the Pentagon that put an end to the longstanding ban on transgender Americans serving in the military. Got a link to some information about that, by the way, over at the Central Time Facebook page. You can share your thoughts, maybe share your experiences serving in the military while you're looking at that.
As Wisconsin's frac sand mining industry has grown, so has its impact on the small geology department at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. As Rich Kramer reports, the department's new responsible mining initiative has funneled around a dozen graduates into jobs with mining companies and environmental consulting firms that support them, but some are worried about the close ties between industry and academia.
Inside American Legion Post 53 near the lower campus of UW-Eau Claire, dozens of students are well-dressed and mingling with parents and potential employers at the Geology Department banquet. It's an annual tradition hosted by Geology Department Chair Kent Severson.
It is my privilege to be announcing some awards and internships and recognizing some stakeholders who have made a huge difference in our program.
Those stakeholders are a handful of frac sand mining companies and others that have donated nearly $150,000 since 2013 for student scholarships and grants, along with equipment for the department. Those donations support UW-Eau Claire's Responsible Mining Initiative. Severson built the program with the help of mining companies and environmental consulting firms. The goal is to expose students to all sides of the mining industry. A hydrogeology class looks at how bad mining practices could impact groundwater. Students even hold a mock county board meeting where developers seek approval for a sand mine. Another major component of the initiative is real-world experience. Severson says this year there were 18 paid internships with combined salaries of more than $140,000.
These paid internships with sand mining companies have given our students valuable experience whether they work in sand mining or not. And the Responsible Mining Initiative isn't just about mining. We're preparing students to work in environmental consulting and to work for regulatory agencies as well.
Nick Matula of Appleton was one of the first geology students to get an internship through the program. Starting in 2014, he worked for Texas-based mining company Smart Sand, which has a plant in Oakdale, Wisconsin. Matula was offered a full-time job as a mining specialist before he even graduated last year.
It is a relief, that's for sure, because the job market everywhere for geologists is kind of low because of commodities. And to be able to have gotten a job in the sand mining industry with Smart Sand, even when the market wasn't necessarily the highest, was very crucial.
But some, like attorney Kellen McLemore of Midwest Environmental Advocates, worry close ties with the industry could influence what the department teaches and researches.
When industry groups provide funding for a specific program or for a specific student, that creates the opportunity for the recipients of those funds to feel maybe an obligation to prescribe to the beliefs or the views of those industry groups.
Geology Department Chair Severson says his program is dedicated to scientific research and donors don't have any control over curriculum. And he argues students wouldn't have the same opportunities without outside support.
We want industry to invest in education. We want the state of Wisconsin to invest in education. And we would be in a world of hurting right now if we didn't have committed stakeholders right now who are helping us out.
Severson says the Responsible Mining Initiative is still in its infancy. He and the geology staff are seeking approval for three new mining-related certificates focused on the relationship between industry, environment, and regulation. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, a guest says Wisconsin's Department of Corrections needs an independent oversight board to prevent problems like the scandal at the Lincoln Hills Youth Facility.
We'll look back on the career of a legendary public radio broadcaster in Wisconsin who just entered the state's Broadcast Hall of Fame.
And July 4th can be a scary time for pets, and we'll get some advice on dealing with animals scared by loud noises like, say, fireworks.
That and more all coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Monday morning after 8, Joy's guest tells us how Americans fell in love with camping as we mark the holiday weekend. That's Monday morning after 8 here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR.
Then we'll learn about the closing arguments in a federal trial looking at Wisconsin's voter ID, voter registration laws, and a lot more when it comes to Election Day. Reporter Sean Johnson brings us up to date and tells us what happened in the courtroom. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.